Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday, the 8th of August. We're on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m, broadcast live from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia. Coming up on this podcast, self-described drongo Patrick Marlborough chats his new book, Knock Loose.
For Weird Science, Dr. Jen took us through how our brains can help ward off colds this winter. And being the mature adults that we are, we discussed our self-imposed rules.
Psychologist Ahona Guha prompts us to think about the rise of ChatGPT therapy. And we welcome into the studio US filmmaker and director of the new film If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, Mary Bronstein.
Triple R.
Patrick Marlborough is a writer, comedian, musician behind the Yeah Nah Review on Substack, and his work has appeared in publications including Rolling Stone, The Guardian, Meanjin, The Saturday Paper, Overland, Crikey, and The Batuta Advocate. Patrick's debut novel is Knock Loose, awarded WA's 2023 Fogarty Prize for an unpublished manuscript, and to tell us about the screwball comedy revenge thriller, the politics watcher, mental health and disability advocate, and self-described drongo joins us now. Patrick, welcome to Breakfast.
Thanks for having me.
You've no stranger to community radio over in WA?
No, yeah, I depend on RTR as a lifeblood, even though they do have a defamation warning every time I come on.
That's there. That's hilarious.
But, make sure they behave themselves.
Can I ask, before we get to the novel, which is, of course, being launched for, the third time tonight?
Yeah, 50th time tonight. State by state. I'm doing it for WA. I'm doing town by town. I'm walking, so.
Nice. Do you enjoy writing about politics?
Enjoys a finicky word. Mm. It's more like I have a compulsion. I wouldn't say it's healthy.
Yeah, lancing a boil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have to do it. I don't enjoy politics at all, and I think that, like, discomfort and the hatred is what drives me to do it, to
be honest. Did anything capture your imagination growing up? Because I imagine you're not necessarily surrounded by people of your age who love talking or thinking about it.
Yeah, so my dad was actually a state Labor MP when I was a kid. Not the kind to get rich, unfortunately, for me. I wish I went to private school. Yeah. I loved wear a kilt. And those Boda hats they have, right? Lead lined, that's why we all end up like that. So I grew up in the Labor Party like a cult. And if you want to get really disillusioned in politics, like, just get raised in it. Because from the age of 3, for me, I was like, God, I hate you people. These are the worst humans I've ever met in my life, and they've yet to top it.
Yeah, so how do you manage to stay angry if you're disillusioned? If there's a standard in your mind that can never be reached.
That's the immortal question of any leftist, right? Mm. Why do you keep going? Because you've got to beat the bastards. At the end of the day, there's nothing that keeps you going like the daydream of seeing them kicked into the mud.
Yeah. I used to love reading Bob Ellis.
Yeah. I used to read Bob Ellis a lot when I was younger as well. Talk about angry bloke. I do vividly remember his portrait of Kim Beazley in like 1997. This is the kind of tragic autism I have. Like,
everybody remember this?
An absolutely vicious takedown that I'm reading at a 16-year-old for fun. So that kind of tells
you. Did
you
know
about
the Beazleys growing up?
Yeah, I don't want to answer.
Okay.
Perth's a small town.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Knock Loose. What are we talking here? You don't even want it. Because this has been
it's
in your.
It's hard to nutshell.
If this won an award.
Oh, you got shortlisted for the award.
Yeah, sure. That's right.
They would never give me money.
You sound pissed off.
Furious.
So it's obviously been in your brain. You've been talking about it for a while and thinking about it for a while.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote it in 10 days. The draft I got shortlisted. But I will bracket that by saying I do have bipolar and, like, mania in certain contexts is a superpower. If you need to write a novel in a week, it can provide you with that. Wow. It will ruin your life in every other way. Yeah. But in terms of churning out novels, easy peasy. The book is a kind of like postmodern, I guess the Australian Book Review compared it to Thomas Pynchon, and that's an easy way for me to describe it. Kind of satire of the small town with a big secret genre. And it's about it's a revenge story set in a fictional town in WA Southwest that hosts a medieval festival every year for the past 150 years, but it's actually violent, and the festival's developed its own metafictional history and lore that's, like, world famous, and everybody from around the world comes and participates in this kind of, like, comical The Purge type thing.
Mm.
Week and Fright meets Game of Thrones meets The Simpsons is my easy sell.
And when you do that sell, does it resonate for you, or is it like, oh, this is for the people, not for me?
I feel marketers and publishers actively wanting to hit me in the mouth. That is how I describe it. I'm like, what the are you talking about? But unfortunately for me, it makes such perfect sense.
Is it? How do you give voice to that instead of what's kind of expected to you?
I think Australian publishing is incredibly cowardly and boring. And I've been on the record saying this as an essayist and a critic for a very long time. And I think my unfortunate contempt for most of the industry really does fuel most of my creative output as a novelist. Like, 'cause I've written 4 other novels that are sitting there waiting to go. So writing something that is not easily categorizable, for instance, like my novel for some reason got stocked in the crime section for the last 2 weeks all around Australia, even though it is not a crime novel in any way. Please, if you see it in the crime section, please put it somewhere else. I don't care where else, just not crime. So if you kind of want to defy categories in Australian publishing, they do just don't know what to do with you, basically.
I'm going
to
put it in the self-help section for you.
Oh, my God. That's going to end.
Yeah, I'm going to go rogue on it.
I promise my publisher wouldn't make any more Nitrim jokes. So
what about fiction reading? We hear about, I don't know, the decline of reading, and you're effectively prolific before your debut's even out.
Yeah, the decline of reading, it's an interesting one, right? Because the thing that has been missed out of that discourse, I think, recently is class, in the sense that, not to be a Marxist on the air, but
go for it.
When people talk about the decline of reading, what they're really talking about is the decline of free time. I've been a voracious reader my whole life because of just how my mum raised me. But I think the time that is required, is particularly to read like interesting literature and quote-unquote difficult literature, whatever that means to you, is quickly disappearing. And whenever I see this conversation going around, which it has been a lot in the media lately, it's framed as like, oh, people are too on their bloody TikToks and on their phones. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but like, dumb bastards has existed from time immemorial and people have been distracted and uninterested in literature since you can go back to the Greeks. It's not that. It's just that people don't have the time, people don't have the energy. And it's, of all mediums, it's the one that requires both those things in quite a large volume.
Do you get a kick out of your own writing as you're going?
Oh, yeah. It's weird, because everything else in life is so gruelingly painful for me. just getting here on the tram today, I was like, oh my, I'm going to fuck this up. But writing is the one thing I find very pleasurable and like really easy, and I could just sit there all day doing it. In a just world, they would just raise the dole by like $200 a week, and I might be happy. I'd just sit there writing.
But you can talk as well, which must help.
Unfortunately, yeah. Yeah, that's one thing I got from my dad. That and the like, kind of stupidity. But the I worked as a comedian, I guess. Yeah. You could say.
What are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading at the moment? Oh, I'm reading a collection of Gary Indiana's essays. Why do I have so much trouble saying his name? Max Laverne, who's a writer in Sydney. One of the great Australian writers, amazing short story writer, self-publishes a lot of his own collections, has a pretty big following online. Again, a really good example of like somebody who the Australian publishing industry should be frothing over, and because they're doing something a little bit outside the box, kind of gets looked over by them, and it's just gone completely DIY, as a lot of interesting writers have in Australia. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he just sent me his new collection yesterday in the post, and I have been reading that.
Cool.
And Max, the name is not coming to me right now, but it's very good. Max Laverne, look him up.
Do you get in a lot of trouble? Like, Patrick, will you stop biting the hand that feeds you?
Yeah, from about the age of 4. I don't know, probably younger. I can't stop. It's unhealthy. I like to say, because I'm autistic, I can say it's actually ableist to tell me to behave myself. Look at the panic that spreads in their faces when you say it as well. Wins every time. Trump car.
And so why are there so many launches? Is it because this land is so massive?
Yeah, no, it's literally that. WA is another country, hey? Like, if you're doing anything in Western Australia, trying to get anybody from over east to notice you is just about impossible. It doesn't matter how talented you are, how good you are, what you're doing. It's becoming harder and harder by the day. I mean, speaking of music, right, like, we were talking about RTR earlier. Without RTR, I feel like so many West Australian artists, not just musicians, couldn't get outside of the state, because all the stepping stones that used to be there when I was younger, like the alt mags and stuff like that, they've all gone. And our one state newspaper doesn't cover the arts anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, unless it's like a Gina Reinhardt related, and if you're doing some Gina poetry or Twiggy Forest DIY punk release, I don't know.
Who owns the newspaper?
It's Stokes.
Yeah.
Personal friend. Yeah, me, Stokes, Stokes and Ben Robert Smith. We're hanging out every weekend.
And is there anything... Could the States communicate better, do you think?
Yeah, so... Because I've worked as a critic for... far out, almost 20 years. Like, since I was 14 or 15, I used to pretend I was 35-year-old Gen X guy and used to write these dueling columns on, like, music releases. The Eastern States, for a lot of reasons, like snobbery, regionalism, just the tyranny of distance, like, don't pay much attention to what's happening in WA. And it's a shame, because WA has a really thriving art scene despite all this. Like, the isolation and the way money works in WA has made our art scene really particular and really weird. And music is the most obvious example. We churn out a lot of, like, quite famous musicians. Eventually they all leave, of course. But because of Whopper, the big performing arts school, we produce a lot of interesting music because you have this mix of, like, really well technically trained, a lot of, like, jazz musicians in particular are merging with, like, guess what, remains of the Dole Wave scene. And it creates a very interesting sound.
Mm.
With literature and theatre and performance, it's kind of the same. Like, you can get away with being a little bit weirder than you can in Melbourne and Sydney. You just know the money's never coming, so it gives you a certain freedom, unless you're willing to take mining money, which most of us aren't.
Yeah, that's right. And evidently you've created, what did you say, 4 novels?
Yeah, I'm sitting on 4 other ones, and, like, 2 of the live shows as well, and those are absolute nightmares. They're harder to make than the books.
So do you pluck Knock Loose out of, it's like, well, that's the best one, or this is the most accessible one?
Right? I do think it's maybe the most accessible. It's the ones that get me in the least trouble. And... I don't know, when I wrote it, like, I wrote it to the prize deadline, which I wrote the first one. I had one that got shortlisted for the prize 2 years before that as well, and that one was, like, twice as long as Knock Loose and a bit more experimental. I need a deadline to just, like, I can get anything done. If you say, yeah, write a book in 7 days right now, I could do it.
Yeah, and the accolades as well.
And the accolades, just chasing nothing it. Like a Western Australian literary award to get you attention and fame.
Bipolar and a deadline. Yeah. Unstoppable. Okay, well, you can catch Patrick Marlborough at the book launch for Knock Loose, which is tonight at 6:30.
Yes.
At Reading, State Library of Victoria, with Evelyn Araluen.
The great Evelyn Araluen, one of the nation's best poets, if not the best living poet.
Truly, that'll be fun. Maybe head to readings.com.au for more events about that. And Knock Loose is out via your mates at Fremantle Press?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
And apologies to Fremantle Press. Good on you. Thanks very much, Patrick.
Jack Kerouac, eat your heart out.
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
Immunity to the joy of Dr. Jen's weird science morning, Dr. Jen.
I hope you don't need immunity tonight.
Yeah,
I'm feeling like that's not a compliment, Daniel.
It's very much a compliment. We're intellectual sitting ducks.
Excellent. So I thought we might start with a little thought experiment. So picture this. You are, well, you can pick. You're on a train or a tram or a cinema or a theatre. You know, you are somewhere and somebody close to you is coughing or sneezing, you know, something that is visibly concerning to you. And I think, I don't know, what do you guys think? I don't think this happens as often post-COVID. It's very non-PC to be coughing or sneezing in public. What do you think?
Well, I walked past a guy yesterday who chose to cough without covering his mouth within 2 metres of me.
Did you freak?
I sidestepped it just for effect.
You're like, dude, my job is to talk.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was inconsiderate.
Yeah.
Mm. I had a friend who, even the whole way through COVID, just didn't get sneezing into the elbow.
Oh.
Like, what is this?
How hard can it be, right?
You should send them an anonymous tip-off.
Anyway, so back to my thought experiment. So you're sitting there and somebody, well, Daniel, you can just think about what happened yesterday. Mm. I think most of us have a behavioural response, yeah? We sidestep, we try not to breathe too deeply, we cover our mouths, you know, we do something.
So I freak out.
You freak out. What does that look like?
Detail. Screaming, running.
Like a toddler hissy fit. Just to point out to the other person that they're not doing the right thing. Mental note, don't ever go near you if I'm sick. But we all, you know, we try and do whatever we think minimises the chance that we'll get sick, correct? Because
mm-hmm.
We have this perception that if we breathe the same air as that person's sneeze or cough, we're more likely to get sick. But have you ever wondered what could be going on in your brain at that time and whether just looking at somebody or seeing somebody who we perceive as sick could actually make our brain tell our immune system to start doing stuff.
Wow.
It's a really, really wild idea. I think probably there's some immunologists listening who are like, yeah, Jen, come on, we know that. But it's something I hadn't really thought about.
I've never thought of that.
No.
I've heard of it, but I thought it was hearsay.
Well.
Well, not hearsay, but yeah.
So I thought it was a pretty crazy idea, and but a paper just came out 2 weeks ago in a very well-respected journal called Nature Neuroscience. And these researchers in Switzerland basically wanted to find out exactly that. They wanted to know whether our brains can anticipate potential infection, even if there's no direct, threat of infection. So you're not breathing in any viral particles or anything like that, and whether the brain can then signal the immune system to take action. So they used virtual reality to test it. So picture this, you've got, I think they had 250 healthy volunteers, and they got them to don Oculus Rift headsets and then take part in these VR simulations, basically having an avatar. So, you know, someone who looks like a person in a virtual environment in a whole lot of different experiments, essentially walking towards them. And some of these avatars looked completely healthy and normal, but some of them displayed visual symptoms that would suggest they had an infectious disease. So in some cases they were visibly coughing, in some they had a skin rash. In some variations of the experiment, they either had a neutral expression on their face, but in some of them they looked frightened. Can you imagine someone looking really scared with a rash all over them coming towards you? Exactly. That's when you panic, right?
Yeah.
That's when you're going to have your
hysteria. I'm going to release this as a horror video. Yeah.
When I was reading about it, I'm like, I just can't help but picture zombies. But
yeah, totally.
I don't think that's what it was about. I think they were normal-looking people avatars. And so they did all sorts of things. Like in one experiment, the participants were asked to press a button as fast as possible after they had an avatar walking towards them, and then someone gently touched their face. So their body is like, oh, my God, this person's really close to me, even if they didn't look close to me. So they did a whole lot of different things. And unsurprisingly, when a person showed a sign of sickness and then someone touched your face, they pressed the button pretty damn fast because they're like, yeah, I see that as a threat. But anyway, so I don't think it's surprising that behaviourally people would step away from somebody who looks sick. That's nothing new. We would all do that.
Mm.
But what makes this study really interesting is that they also looked at two other things. One was what was going on in the brain during these simulations, and one what was going on in the blood. So for the brain part of it, they used two really cool techniques. One is called EEG, and EEG is electroencephalography, and I think I said that right. That's the one where they put electrodes on someone's brain and work out what electrical signals are going on in the brain. They also used fMRI, which we've talked about a few times. That's functional magnetic resonance imaging. That's where it's also non-invasive, so both of these are non-invasive, and that's where they work at which parts of the brain are active based on blood flow. So they're looking at exactly which parts of the brain are active as these frightened, sick-looking avatars are coming towards you. And so that means they're monitoring in real time what the brain's perceiving. But that also really cool thing was that straight after the exposure on virtual reality, they collected blood samples. And they looked specifically at two types of immune cells. One are called innate lymphoid cells and one are called natural killer cells. And both of them are really important in the early phases, kind of like the first line of defense against an infection. And to cut to the chase, they found that both the brain and the blood are showing that just perceiving a threat is enough for the body to basically take action.
No way.
Which is really, really cool. So
that's super subliminal.
It is. So when these people wearing their Oculus Rift headsets, when they viewed an avatar who was showing signs of sickness, the brain activated regions both that were connected with detecting a threat and kind of bodily awareness, so awareness of the space close to your body. So our brains are immediately like, something bad is going on close to us. So that's, I guess maybe that's not surprising that the brain is immediately tuning into this potential threat. But even more amazing was the fact that the immune system was already kicking into gear. So just by seeing somebody who was sick, the brain is like, oh, there's a threat here. We need to take action. It's somehow communicating directly to the immune system. And both of those types of cells that I said were really important in the immune response, they both increased. They both went up.
I wonder what the result would be, or the impact for someone who's maybe like a hypochondriac or something like that.
Interesting. You would expect maybe even more, like if you're more primed to perceiving a threat.
But also it seems like it would be exhausting if you see threats everywhere. It's changing your blood.
Well, that's, I mean, that's the thing that they say we need to look at next. We don't understand fully yet, you know, this really intricate, amazing communication between the brain and the immune system. Obviously, we've known for a long time these two things are really closely connected. But, like, the blood response, so the increase in these two types of immune cells, is it enough to actually fight off an infection, or is it a, you know, some kind of brief, short-lived response that then doesn't eventuate any further? Because, you know, is it a cost to us to be producing these cells that we potentially don't need if we're perceiving visually this threat but it doesn't actually eventuate? They did an interesting control where they gave some people in the study a flu vaccine, to compare the kind of level of immune response where your body is actually being challenged by an infection. Obviously, you know, a flu shot is giving you a very, very, very mild exposure to the flu. And they found that it was roughly similar. So whether you're actually getting a flu vaccination or whether you just perceiving somebody who's sick, there is a similar level of change in immune cells. It's pretty amazing. I mean, I don't know, maybe some people listening be like, yeah, that just seems entirely logical to me. Surely we've evolved to have such a finely tuned immune response because our immune system is so fundamental to us staying alive. But I just never thought before about the fact that our amazing immune systems might be so primed that actually it doesn't have to come into contact with any sort of infection-causing a particle or whatever. It could just be perceiving that there could be the risk of that happening.
My brain just wants to see an attempt at mitigation. There needs to be more hankies.
Oh, interesting.
Hey, I'm a hanky person.
Good.
People rubbish
me. Where is your hanky?
Yeah. It's in my pocket of my jacket. I have a hanky with me all the time. People think I'm so old-fashioned.
I thought all hanky people kept them up their sleeve. Is that just me, or do I have all mums and grandmas pulling tissues and hankies out of their sleeves?
It is. It kind of reminds me, I guess we all have, like, adrenaline storage ready to go, and if we perceive a threat...
Yep.
That's when it kicks in. Rather, even if there is no threat, it just sometimes automatically kicks in.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Our bodies have evolved to be ready to take a sensible response to any sort of threat. And exactly, adrenaline is always there ready to help us with the whole kind of, you know, fight or flight response. And this is just another level of understanding that what's going on in our bodies is that we are super ready to respond to this other kind of threat. And I guess... I think it just challenges that traditional view that our immune system is there to take action once we've been exposed to something infectious. And in fact, actually, it's ready way before that. And it's important because understanding how our brains anticipate the risk of an infection could be really helpful in terms of coming up with new treatments and new strategies for tackling infectious diseases. And I'm thinking particularly about managing diseases where a quick immune response is really important before things kind of go downhill in our body systems too quickly. Understanding more about this communication between the brain and the immune system, which we understand some aspects of really well, but I think some aspects we don't understand very well at all, developing that understanding could really help with a whole lot of disease treatments in the future. So it's pretty exciting. And I just like the fact that, you know, it was done using VR, imagining these frightened, sick-looking people coming towards you. I think you're right, Daniel. I think it has to be a video game.
It will. The Skin Rash virtual reality zombie will be in stores for Christmas. Dr. Jen, see you next week for more incredible weird science.
Yeah, see you then.
Triple R on FM, digital, online, and via the app.
Growing up, we had no TV nights in our house. Monday, Tuesday nights, it was just no TV allowed, which I hated because I'm pretty sure Friends was on Monday or Tuesday night, and I would just try and find a workaround.
Monday was huge. It was Friends and ER maybe as well.
Mum, that bitch.
That's its response.
Yeah, there was, I remember there was like a small TV in the back room and we used to like put headphones in and watch it. Like, just wouldn't take the rule lying down. Just no way.
Yeah.
Just any way around it. I'm going to Dad's house. See ya. But, you know, that's one of the many joys of becoming an adult, isn't it? Like, you know, once you turn 18 or a certain age, that you have control about how you spend your free time. And, you know, that's just the one of the wonders of being an adult. But then, you know, you find we have to kind of put limitations and self-imposed rules on us as we get older for, you know, various reasons. You know, the most common one you hear people talk about is like no phones, you know, maybe no starting a new TV show until you've finished one, no online shopping after so many glasses of wine or, I mean, you name it, it's endless. People are just constantly coming out with these different rules.
Easy to enforce the no glasses of wine, no online shopping after 8 glasses of wine.
How's it easy to enforce?
Very. I feel like after about 8 glasses of wine, you have just so much discipline.
Yeah.
And you're very focused. And
I'll never forget being at my sister's house and her getting a package delivered for J-Lo's perfume. And I go, what's happened? She goes, I got drunk. And I ordered the perfume as a joke. Anyway, I mean, if that's not reckless behavior, I don't know what it is. What is? But I just thought, like, that is the last thing I would ever expect her to buy.
J-Lo.
J-Lo perfume. And anyway, then, but I came across this bizarre rule just yesterday. So organizing a movie night with a friend. And I'm like, okay, I can do Friday, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh, okay, bit of an annoying text from me. I have a blanket rule, no movies on Fridays.
Really?
Yeah, a self-imposed rule. They're like, no, it's just, and I can get it to a certain extent. Basically, the reasons that were given were just like, oh, I know it's just end of the week, maybe just a bit more steam to blow off, and just maybe not going to be the vibe. And then he went on to say, like, in all circumstances, that's just a rule that he's applied. And he's like, it's a shame because there's a lot of great films at MIFF. So he's enforcing it strongly.
Wow.
Yeah. And I wasn't going to give too much pushback. I was like, look, I would respect it. I would just completely step away if it was summer and it was more weather related. But I go, it's winter and we've got to cling to whatever we've got.
Yeah.
To get through the next couple of months.
Yeah, one of my favourite ever decisions I've ever made was watching that Drive My Car movie on Friday night.
Drive My Car.
It's like this Japanese movie.
Oh my God, the Murakami.
Yeah.
That's a short story. And that movie goes forever.
The movie is better than the book. It's the one exception.
I don't know. I reckon I could fight you on this. It's a great car, though. I love the old Saab 900.
So I don't know. Movies Fridays.
So that just looms large in your mind.
Yeah. Great way to just clock off the week, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of work, get into just to shut off everything, go deep on a movie.
Exactly. You could definitely apply the same logic that he is applying to why he doesn't want to watch movies. It's just like, nah, end of the week, kind of just want to unwind. He doesn't want to unwind with the movie. He just thinks it's, too much of a sleepy activity.
Crazy.
And it's just like he doesn't trust that he'll be able to maybe maintain his focus.
My brain's fried. Let's go turbo.
And on one hand, it's like I get it because I've always considered myself a Friday night gal. I love the energy of a Friday.
Mm.
I don't like that. I feel like they're just always more fun than Saturdays because it's just that collective energy. You're coming off the work week. Yes, you're tired, but I don't know. Everyone's guards down a bit more because you are a bit more tired. Mm. The conversation flows a bit more. Sometimes you go into a Saturday with too much expectation. If you haven't been working that day, you're like, oh, I'll get ready. And there's all this hype and build up. And then you get there and you're like, well, this is Saturday night.
Mm.
But Friday, you just roll into it.
It's just happening.
Yeah.
Knockoffs. And then you're launching.
Your lodgie, yeah, or whatever activity that you want to do.
Yeah.
But in general,
I'm a
huge fan of the Friday night. Mm. If we're looking at, you know, the classic weekend.
Best night.
I think it's superior to Saturday.
Mm.
Yeah, I said it. I think Saturday's too much hype, too much
build up. I can't wait for tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow's Friday. And then they say Thursday is the new Friday. Woo-hoo. So I've definitely got a penchant for Thursday.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm a purist. Well, do you two have a favourite day of the week, or do you have any self-imposed rules?
Mm. I don't watch television on the weekend. Like, I wouldn't watch a series.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like, it's a marquee. You got to watch your films.
Okay. Mm. Yep.
There's no piecemeal mucking around here.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Settle in, damn it. Into it.
Yeah, bust into the good stuff, like the top shelf. Go to your Criterion collection or something like that, or go to the list of all-time great films. You know, I'm getting that kind of vibe.
Mm. But, yeah, I suppose even going to the cinema, I try and, I don't know, but I get there, I like to see the previews.
Mm. I love the previews too.
Yeah. So
money's worth.
Yeah, bloody oath. It's not as bad as I'm hearing in the States it's like can be 30 minutes until the 40. Movie starts.
You want 40?
And a 3-hour movie.
Exactly. I'm leaving mid-movie, but I'm there for the previews.
Yeah,
that's a good rule, self-imposed, got to catch the previews.
Yeah. And I don't even mind. I love it when they do something creative with the – I know they do it at the Thornbury Picture House. Like they cut or edit together the clips to turn off your phone.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that as well. You know, it's always good. It's just building the anticipation and the tension.
Could borrow them for work.
Yeah.
I met someone who had maybe 8 espressos a day.
Yes.
But
this is what I want.
He stopped after midday.
Okay.
Hey, there you go.
I've got that rule. Mm. No coffees after midday.
Midday.
Yeah. Which did Dr. Jen talk about that? It might have come up at some point.
Yeah. And I've heard 3 p.m. Cafes tend to wind down. So psychologically that's.
Yeah. It's.
But yeah, his one was midday. Oh,
Susie Siped. Dr. Susie that's talked right. about it. Yep. I like 8. I feel like you should be going for 10 though.
10 before midday.
Yeah.
I'm sure his doctor would say about that.
Oh,
I mean, it's full on. That's full on.
We had a rule at schoolies, which this is a very schoolies rule, that you had to have.
That's such a good way to start a story. We had a rule at schoolies. And I try to apply it to everything I do now moving forward. That should be a book.
Yeah. Which I like. Yeah, I think extremes are good. So it was one beer before 10. Or 10 beers before 1. So if you slept in,
nice.
You're in for a big sesh that day.
There are some rules like that that are so like inverse or poetic that it feels true.
Yeah.
It feels inviable, even though it's total nonsense.
Yeah. Because you could do that for coffees, like 1 before midday or 10.
Before 12. Yeah. No, hang on.
Or, yeah, 10 after 12.
Okay. That's right.
And no breakfast. Yeah. Either way, you're spewing.
Yeah. What other ones? Being the good Catholic boy that I am not.
Yeah.
But I still cling on to fish and chip Fridays.
Oh, good for you. That's so interesting.
Meat-free Mondays. I think that's a Paul McCartney one.
So you still do that?
I try.
God, it's claws in
And it. What about Sunday roast?
Well, chocolate sundaes. Got to eat as much chocolate as you can on Sundays.
Really? It was always lolly night Friday.
Oh, lolly night Friday.
Yeah, you get the bags out and you divvy them. Oh, but I'll extend it to Sunday as well.
I wonder, yeah, could you do maybe like no social media before?
Don't try and put a... No, let's stick with the beer before 10 a.m., otherwise 10 after. Don't try and make this adult and healthy. No, I'm going
But then just say Wednesday. Or maybe it's TikTok Tuesday, so you can only... You have to be on TikTok
You can't take your eyes off. Yeah. You're binging TikTok.
10 hours of TikTok. Just glued in.
Triple R.
Dr. Ahona Guha is a clinical and forensic psychologist, author, trauma expert, and familiar voice on Breakfasters, who joins us again this morning. Ahona, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, it's kicking off, isn't it? ChatGPT therapy.
Look, it has been for a while. I've certainly seen it in my own therapy rooms now, probably for about 3 months or so. Seems to have become increasingly common, but I think we've started to talk about it a lot more, and I think there's a lot more political interest in it now. Mm. And that seems to have broken over the past month or so, so I'm very curious about it.
What's a tell that a patient or client has been using ChatGPT?
I think the increasing reach of tech, just how very, very normalised it is as part of our world. I think a sense of increasing desperation as well sometimes. You know, difficulty sitting with difficult emotion or with questions as well. And I think one of the things that I struggle with in terms of AI therapy is just the reach of it, the fact that you can turn your phone on and it's always there, which is not the way therapy is meant to work.
Is there a general concern within professionals about, like, yeah, the rising...
I think so. I think there are different approaches. There are some people who are very interested in it and are absolutely jumping onto it and are quite eager to change their practices. There are others who are a hardcore no. Mm-hmm. And there are some like me who maybe sit in the middle. I tend to sit on the slightly more cautious side, and I know that there's no evidence around this at the moment, so it's not something that I'm either rushing to engage in or to naysay. I think there's quite a spectrum, but there's certainly conversations about it, which certainly means that it's coming to people's attention, and it's a wave that has come, a wave that is going to grow, something that we have to be grappling with.
Why is therapy not meant to be that way in the pocket?
Look, I think it depends on how you define therapy, right? And I don't think that there's a certain one answer that I really subscribe to. I think you've got at one end the really depth focused insight. Oriented psychotherapy, and then you have maybe the more Medicare model 10 session. We are going to be working more on really specific problems and skills. So I think if you look at the skills building approach, then I think that yes, ChatGPT or bots can be helpful because it can talk you through skills. It can maybe remind you to do your breathing. But if you're looking at either a mix of problems, which is honestly what I often see more in my own therapy rooms, given I do a lot of work with trauma, you never have the one discrete issue. Mm. There's often a mix of insight, of actually learning to sit with distress and of trying to find meaning. Mm. Therapy gives you spaces and time to pause so you can actually absorb some of what you're learning and thinking. And a big part of that is about learning to sit with difficulty. Whereas I think with ChatGPT or with any AI bot, you don't get that. You want an answer and it's right there. And that's just going to breed dependence.
I was just going to say, I've just had a number of friends recently saying that they have been using it and finding it really helpful. I've definitely tried it. It can definitely just help maybe offer tools of like reframing a situation or something like that. And I guess as well, there's a positive, like, in terms of access to something.
Exactly.
Therapy, psychoanalysis.
It's cheap, it's free. Well, it's cheap or it's free.
It's free, yeah. Do you see any other kind of positives coming out of it?
I think the positives are maybe for some in-between session work based on the sort of work that you're doing. If you're really struggling to, as you say, reframe something, that can be helpful. I think one of the tools that I tend to work with most of my clients on is really starting to become their own therapist. So they can understand the way that their brains work. They can know, for instance, whether they catastrophize or whether they are prone to maybe projecting their own difficulties onto other people so that they can start to spot those patterns. I suppose ChatGPT type therapy can be helpful for that, but I also wonder whether it's doing the thinking for you. Mm-hmm. So you're never actually having to do the hard work of starting to understand your own internal processes, your own emotions, your own thoughts, so you can become your own therapist.
You're not building your own muscles.
Exactly.
Or exercising
your
own muscles.
You've got this machine that is, you know, you know, it kind of reminds me of the old time days, one of those little machines that you might stand on that would just kind of shake you with the idea that that vibrates your fat off. That's what it reminds me of.
Great analogy.
Yeah. If you're flat broke, or there's reporting of people using it in war zones, is it better than nothing?
Look, I think so. I think that there's absolutely space for these types of models. I don't want to be overly protectionistic and say that it has to be depth-focused therapy or absolutely nothing. I think in spaces where there's no access to anything else, or there may be no access to funding, then it's probably, for some types of difficulties, going to be better than nothing. Mm. However, it very much depends on the type of difficulty. For instance, it can't treat PTSD. Mm. It can't do certain types of therapy. It can't diagnose. It can't assess. It can't provide human insights. It is essentially just a large data model that gathers information from a lot of sources, including a lot of copyrighted information that's been stolen, mind you, from therapists. I know one of my own books has been used as part of the data set used to train it. So my first book, which I'm still very pissed off about. So just being aware, I think, of the drawbacks. And I honestly think that for certain types of difficulties like OCD, it's probably going to make things worse, because part of things like OCD is just seeking reassurance. Mm. And if you've got that on tap, then you're never breaking the cycle, which is, you know, one of the really hard things about treating OCD.
Can I ask as well, are there any concerns about confidentiality in these type of personal scenarios people would be sharing?
I think I read recently that if you make a chat public, they forgot to turn a function off that stopped Google from indexing chats. So I think I read about this over the weekend that a lot of chats have been indexed. There is absolutely no provider patient confidentiality, because there is no provider and there's really no patient there. So the kinds of things that you would have a trained psychologist, a doctor keep private is probably being mined to be used in some capacity. There are essentially no checks and balances beyond the ethics of tech bros, and that might be a little bit lacking.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea of just reflecting what you want back to you?
I think that's a big, you know, one of the very, very big issues for me. I ran a little experiment where N equals one a while ago, and I pretended that I thought I was the queen of the universe, and I tried to break a couple of different AI models. They all agreed that I was the queen of the universe, mind you.
Congrats.
Pretty nice, thank you, and had me doing breathing practices to channel my power. But this was just me really testing it out. But if you think of something like someone who might have more paranoid beliefs, or someone who's maybe engaging in intimate partner violence but trying to justify their own behaviors, that is the sort of thing a large language model, which is essentially created and really coded to suck up to people, to, you know, validate, is going to reinforce. Mm. So I think we're going to see a lot of reinforcing of really difficult behaviors, of harm toward self, harm toward others, psychosis, all of these types of things coming about as a result of ChatGPT therapy. Mm. It's going to make us worse.
Oh, broadly?
Broadly, it's going to make us worse versions of ourselves, because it's going to say, yes, you're right, do that, continue doing that. There is no challenging unless you are seeking that. And the problem is that most people who need that sort of challenging don't have the insight maybe to really know that.
Mm. And so if you... It's because there are some therapists who I've read use it and find it not a therapist, but therapeutic. And I suppose if you've got the nous to question.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about your use of it, isn't it? It's about the prompts you put in. So the people who are going to use it well are probably people who have a range of critical thinking skills, who have some good self-insight, who are able to understand and really comprehend complex questions, and people who can filter through as well and know that, you know, some use is probably okay, but this is where I draw the line. Mm. But for the majority of people who are more troubled, who might be going to therapy, those are all skills that they build up within the frame of the, you know, therapy relationship. So they won't have those skills right at the outset. And I fear that ChatGPT-based models are going to play right into that.
How do you know it swallowed your book? How'd you test it?
There was a data set released, and I think it was on the Atlantic, maybe, but it allowed you to search the data set to see whether your books were used, and I found my first book. So, yep, it was essentially stolen by AI.
Terrific!
Oh my god, what a world! We
well, you should talk it through with ChatGPT. You know, work through the
what
emotions.
Do I do about yeah, this? Yeah.
Well, Dr. Hona Guha, it's certainly not going away, and I look forward to checking with you about this issue or many others related to mental health.
If I still have a job. Yeah. Who knows? I might be a dog walker.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Hey, Mary Bronstein is a writer, director and actor whose 2008 debut feature, Yeast, starring herself with alongside Greta Gerwig, premiered at South by Southwest and became a mumblecore classic with the Lo-Fi Monument to Brooklyn's indie sleaze era, enjoying a revival with recent screenings at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, Roxy Cinema in New York, and sold-out repertory screenings at LA and London. Mary's latest film is If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which premiered at Sundance and stars Rose Byrne, who scooped the Berlin Film Festival Award for Best Performance, and now If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is the open-night film at MIFF tonight with other screenings besides, and we're very fortunate to have the writer and director in studio with us now. Mary Bronstein, welcome to Breakfasters.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You seem a bit surprised that people know things about your life.
Well, I'm just a person. No, it's funny because, all of my work up until this point, I guess, is what I would call like underground. Yeast is like a cult classic, I guess, now. That's been written.
Yes.
Quoting it. I didn't say that.
You didn't call it a Lo-Fi Monument to Brooklyn's
Brooklyn Sleaze.
Yes. But
which
music
I
did.
Love. Yeah. I love. I mean, me Brooklyn Sleaze is accurate for that film. And for me at the time. But now, it's not underground anymore. It's above ground. Mm. And, my movie's opening the festival tonight. I still can't believe it.
Yeah. It was interesting. I heard you talking about shooting on video versus film.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about, I don't know, underground cinema and getting things up and, I don't know, your plucky spirit.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's I'm not a format snob, okay? I love movies, and I feel like if you are gonna love the high stuff, the high art, you gotta love the low, right? Mm. Because otherwise, I don't trust you. So I can talk about. You know, Fellini till the cows come home, but I also can talk about Dr. Phil till the cows come home, and it's all part of the same thing. And so as far as like video and film, I was lucky enough. It's a money issue. Mm. And what I always say is like, if John Cassavetes was around now, you know, he made his films by like stealing scraps of film and splicing them together and then making his movies. And if he was around now, he would be making his movie on an iPhone. Mm-hmm. Because if you must make art, you find the materials to make it with mm-hmm. what your resources are. If you're a painter and you can't afford paint, you're going to figure out how to get color on paper, right? And I feel that way about movies. And I feel like if the independent, real... Did you use the word plucky?
Yeah.
Plucky. Spirit has to stay alive. There has to be young people making films on whatever they can. Yeast was made on mini DV, which was already outdated when I was doing it. It was what we could afford. It was the cameras that we could get. Everybody was already moved on to this Panasonic Red. I was going to say a bad word. But anyway, whatever. So on this movie, I wanted to work on film. Somebody else was paying for it. Mm. And I could do it. And so I did. And I feel grateful that I got to work with that medium. By the way, when Rose Byrne came for her camera test, she looked at the camera and said, "Is that a film camera?"
Wow.
I have not worked with a film camera in over 20 years.
Really?
Because she's done so much TV. And now, frankly, a lot of people just don't do it.
Wow.
Because it's a different skill. You need to know how to do the camera. You need to know how to change the film. You need to know how to, like, and so, you know, it's like I said, high and low. The next one might be me spending $500 and making a movie on a camcorder.
Mm.
I don't know.
Mm.
For this movie, it was correct.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel. Like, sometimes something is meant to be a poem, and sometimes something is meant to be a novel. Sometimes something's meant to be on film. Sometimes it's whatever you can get. If you must do it, I want people to do it.
Yeah. Well, now we're at a disadvantage having not seen the film. Of course, the opening.
You're going to see it tonight.
Yeah,
you're coming.
Oh yeah.
You're going to come. You're going to come.
Yeah.
And then we're going to party after.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we're talking motherhood. Is it difficult to talk about? Do you find that selling the film does it a disservice in any way? Or because I've read that, you know, it can be a touchy subject.
Yeah. It's not a touchy subject. Look, I don't know how to sell a film. I don't know. I know how to make a film. I know how to write a film. I don't know how to sell a film. But I can talk honestly about what I was trying to do with the film, which was really trying to capture something on screen that I had never seen before, but that everybody that I know with children, and by the way, men and women, mothers and fathers. It's a type of existential crises that can happen when you realize all of a sudden that you are entirely responsible for the well-being, not even the well-being, but the life or death of another human being. And what happens when those situations become more intense than a typically growing child, what happens when other stresses happen, it piles on top of you, and what's the hair that's going to break the camel's back? But of course, mothers, the way that we think of mothers in literature and movies and even in life, in society, certainly in American society, there is no hair that can break the back, because you're almost like mothers are almost like the most revered and the most disrespected at the same exact time, right? Because we all have mothers, right? Or we wouldn't be here. And everyone has a certain relationship with their mother. It could be good, bad. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you weren't raised by your mother. Maybe whatever. Maybe you loved your mother more than anything in the world. That woman is a human being who at some point in your life was going through a hell that you didn't know about. Mm. And that's the space in which the movie takes place.
It's such an evocative title as well. Like, I feel like it instantly communicates like what you were talking about there and the struggle. Yeah, if I had legs, I'd kick you. Did that come from a specific moment or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a real title whore. Can I say whore?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm a title whore.
Yeah.
I love titles. I love a good title. I love a good title. And so, you know, Yeast was, what are we going to name this movie? All of a sudden, Yeast. Yes, this movie is called Yeast. With this movie, so If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is a phrase that came to me when I was in college, which was, you know, last year. was much longer ago than that. I wrote it down. I never forgot it. I didn't know what it was for. I didn't know why it popped in my head. When I started writing the script, I was like, remember that phrase that I wrote down 20 years ago? Yeah. Yeah, that's why. It was for this movie.
That's the needle movie.
And it is, it's one of those magical, weird brain things that happened, and the title is a mouthful, but it when you see the movie, what I also love is that everyone will have their own interpretation of what that title means, which is fascinating to me.
Why is there an Oscars host in this film?
Why? Mm. Because it's Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
Conan O'Brien. I had been a fan of Conan's since his late night, since he took over for Letterman. I don't know how prevalent that is here in America. That was a big deal. And the late night wars, right? And I've been watching him my whole life since I was a young teenager. I didn't know who was going to play the therapist. And one night I was listening to his podcast, which I love. And I was listening to his voice and I thought, you know what? If he gave me advice, I'd listen to it. Mm. I would take it. Right? Yeah. He's got one of those voices. And then I kept it to myself because, like, what a wild idea. Just so happens that the next day, Josh Safdie, who's one of the producers on the film and a dear, dear friend of mine, texted me and said, I have a crazy idea for the therapist. I'm going to type it here. Don't make a reaction. Think about it. And I'm like looking at the little dots coming up. Conan O'Brien. And I go, shut up. What are you talking about?
That is good.
It was a symbiotic, weird moment. And I said, how did you arrive at that? Because I have my story. He goes, no, I thought the therapist is really smart, right? So I typed in smartest celebrities and Conan came up on top. And I was like, that's incredible.
Wow.
Well, it must be the correct idea because we both had it. And I approached Conan, said, yeah, I'll do it.
Mm.
His podcast, I think, was just named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential.
Oh, he's an amazing interviewer.
Mm.
Very skilled interviewer and improvisationalist, which he does on the podcast. When you see the film, anyone that's going to go see the film, whatever you would expect that Conan O'Brien is going to do in this film, you will be surprised in the best way.
Right.
Awesome.
Goodness me. This
what
is all
yeah,
very exciting. If I had legs, I'd kick you. Is the opening night film for MIFF, I suspect tonight is sold out, but perhaps get on the MIFF website. But there is still a session left at the Astor, which yes. is a gorgeous cinema.
And I will be there as well.
Oh, how exciting.
I'm going to come to the second screening. I'm going to do a Q&A.
Mm-hmm. Awesome theatre.
Brilliant.
You'll love that.
Okay, that's this Saturday, 9th of August at 9:45. Head to the MIFF website and enjoy the combination of all this creative serendipity, which is If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You.
Thank you,
Mary
guys.
Goldstein. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Triple R.
Thanks for listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters, the Monday to Friday breakfast show broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.